We're continuing our study in the book of James tonight, and we're in chapter 4. I think we all recognize or identify James chapter 3 by its subject, teaching about the tongue. So we really do think of James 3 as a chapter about the tongue, which it very much is in large part. James chapter 4 is very much a chapter, if we wanted to look at it, summarize it in a basic point similar to chapter 3. I mean, James chapter 4 is a lot about pride. Going back to the beginning of the chapter, as we're now nearing its end, but just to try to get get an overview of it to appreciate the context that we've been studying from for a while in this chapter. And he started the chapter talking about some of the problems that were among these brethren. And these are Christians he's writing to, and he speaks of the wars and fightings that were among them. Where does that come from? I mean, what do we know from Proverbs 13? In verse 10, only by what cometh contention? Only by pride cometh contention. So when they're having these wars and fightings among them, their hearts were not humble. And that was one of the big problems that they had. And so that was manifest there. And then he focused on their love for their friendship with the world, their love of the world. Well, what is that? I mean, who made us and who do we belong to? God? For us to take the life God has given to us and to not use it to seek the one who made us that we belong to, but rather to give our love and affection and have our friendship with the things that he has made and not him. Is that humble not to glorify God as God? And that's not humble either. And so then what did he, after addressing those specific problems, what did he then teach starting in verse 6? Well, there's a way not to receive God's wrath, but what is that way? What was the cure for those problems that they had? Well, they needed to humble themselves because God resists the proud and gives his grace to the humble. So they needed to, verse 7, submit yourselves therefore to God. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. And then verse 8, to draw near to God and he'll draw near to us. And that involves that work on our hearts, the inner man, which is the source of what our hands and all of our members are doing, as we also saw about the tongue in chapter 3. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Cleansing our hands. What do we have to do to cleanse our hands? It's not wash it at a sink. We've got to work on our hearts, which is the source of whatever our hands, whatever our members, our flesh is doing. So that's why he said, purify your hearts in verse 8. And we'll get verse 9, the principle there that we looked at is going to come back at the beginning of chapter 5 that we may be getting into a bit in a while tonight. But to be afflicted and mourn, well, they needed to change. And the things that they were loving and enjoying and rejoicing in, that needed to change. So they needed to be afflicted. They needed to mourn and weep, and that laughter they were having and what they were enjoying needed to be turned to mourning and their joy to heaviness. They needed to repent and then seek what is from above and have their affections there. And then, of course, verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord and he will lift you up. And then we had verses 11 and 12 that were, we might think it was returning to chapter 3. I mean, it certainly is tied into what we studied there. So it's building on that. But verses 11 and 12, for us not to speak evil one of another, especially in the context of passing eternal judgment on one another. well, when we do that, or if we do that, what are we putting ourselves in position as? Above the law, and as one who's judging the law, not just judging our brother, because if the Lord is the one that's reserved that judgment to himself and is going to use his law as the standard of judgment, well, when we say, well, that's not good enough, I'm going to do it. Well, is that humble? Not at all, because then we're putting ourselves in the position there of judging the law instead of following it. And he reminds us in verse 13, there's one lawgiver who's able to save and to destroy. I mean, who are we to judge another? So that's another facet of teaching us humility. And then we get to verses 13 through 15 that we read last week. Go to now, you that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there and buy and sell and get gain. What, are those humble words? They're not. They're not humble words. Now, we may think, well, what's wrong with that? Well, what did we note about it? What does he tell us about that in verse 14? Whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. For that you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that. So there's a right way to speak on as far as what our intentions are, what our plans or purposes might be, and expressing what we intend to do, and what we plan to do. Well, that we do plan things, and we have intentions. We have a will to do certain things. But what power do we have to make any of that come to pass on our own? Zero. It's if the Lord, if he wills, then we will live and do this or that, or carry out whatever plans, that purposes that we might have. We don't know what's going to be on, not just the morrow, but at any moment. One of my colleagues, physician, that's in works in my company, 4 years older than I am. He just died this morning. No expectation whatsoever. I mean, that's just how many things like that happen, and we don't know what's going to be on the morrow. I mean, he certainly was not planning to be leaving this world this morning. But those, it happens, and the Lord tells us about those things. And so for us to say, I will do this, or I'm going to do that, I'm going over here, I'm going to do that, we can't speak that way and be right. We don't have that power. So we're really then claiming to have a power we don't, when we say, I'm going to do whatever, because we don't have that power. Only God has that power to give us life, to give us anything, and to make it possible for us to go anywhere or do anything. And we need to speak that way and give him the credit and the glory for all of those things. What is our life? He says in verse 14, it is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. And that is so true. I mean, we're here for such a brief time, and then we're gone. No matter how long that life is. I mean, have you ever heard anybody that has expressed, no matter what age they are, that I sure feel like I've been here forever? This has just gone so slow. This life has just crept by. I can't believe I'm still here. I mean, people don't talk like that, do they? Any of us feel that way, like we've really been here a long time, and it's just so slow for the time to pass? No, it is. It really goes by so fast, and we know that. We can certainly relate to that experience, and we don't have to live very long to be able to recognize that. But the days, the years, they fly by, and then they're gone. We're here for such a little time. What is the length of our days on this earth? Well, we don't know for any one of us. What does the Lord say about what might be an average or a benchmark that he uses for the lifespan of a man? Mm-hmm. In Psalm 90, when we look at that, Psalm 90, it's a prayer of Moses, the man of God. So these are actually words that God spoke through Moses. So this goes back to the foundation of the nation of Israel, and at the time when he gave his law to the children of Israel. So this would be, now from our standpoint, this would be 3,500 years ago in that neighborhood. So it was quite a while ago that when Moses walked the earth. So how much, when we think of what people knew or understood in the time of Moses, what people knew 2,500 years ago in that area, what did people know about science? I mean, how much did they know of science? I mean, they obviously, I mean, you look at the pyramids that were built in Egypt, and I mean, they did know some things. God did give some wisdom and understanding in those things to man then. But how much did they know about how the human body works, or about disease, and how about what's too small to be seen with the eye of man, microscopic things, and viruses and bacteria and all that kind of stuff that we know a lot about now compared to then. But I mean, we think of the advancements in medical science and that sort of thing, and especially in that's occurred in recent years, very recent years. I mean, how long has it been since some of the things that we just really take for granted nowadays, some of the kinds of operations that can take place that every day in lots of hospitals all over the world, but it wasn't many decades ago. I mean, within the lifetime of people in this room, there are people that are in this room right now that those things didn't exist. It wasn't possible in their earlier part of their lives. I mean, right here. So there's a lot of things that have changed just in very recent years. With all of that, with all of the things that we know and the equipment we have, the know-how, and all these advancements and treatments that we have, how has it changed the life of men? Well, it's interesting. Let's read from what the Lord said 3,500 years ago, and see what things were like back in that time, in the time of Moses. He says in verse 10, "The days of our years are 70 years and 10, and if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet is their strength labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off and we fly away." Verse 12, the point is, "So teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom." But look what he said in verse 10, which is the basis of verse 12. 70 years, or by reason of strength, 80. So we're looking at between 70 to 80 years for a lifespan. I mean, what's the lifespan of humans now? Is it really much different? It's not. With all of this that's changed, that hasn't. Who's in charge of it? Who's in control of all of this? It's God. So this is what he said then, and that's not a long time. I mean, think of eternity and how, even if we even if we are given special strength, we make it into our 80s. You know, some may make it a little past that, but still, how long is that really? It's not long at all. How valuable is it for us to spend that very brief time that we have here learning to love what's here on this earth and having our affection and our heart and our treasure here rather than on what's above. And then all of a sudden we're lost and without all of those things in an eternity where that doesn't exist. That wouldn't be wise. If we consider that our life is but a vapor, and that we're here for just a little while, and then we're gone. So it's like a puff of smoke. What does he say we should do? Well, then we need to, he says, so teach us to number our days. This is something we need to think about. Not to think about, is it so, oh, I'm here such a short time, and then get all depressed and cry. What's the point of that? That isn't going to affect how long we're here. But that's not why we need to number our days so that we can get all sad about it. It's so that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. We've got a little bit of time. God has made available his wisdom for us to be able to know and to be able to seek and find. And we better spend this time doing it and be ready for the eternity to come. And if that's what we do, then, of course, we're going to leave this world soon enough, and we're going to be in eternity. But if that's what we love, and our hearts are formed in the righteousness of God and his love, when we go to eternity, what do we have? We still have all that we love. And so that's the wisdom in that. But he reminds us of how short our life is there in verse 14. We shouldn't be talking about, well, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. We don't know whether we're going to have tomorrow, let alone tonight or the next hour. And so we ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live. If God wills, then we'll have tomorrow. But if he doesn't, we won't. If God wills, then we'll be able to... We'll be able to go home safely tonight. But how many people to this very day were going somewhere and never made it to their destination? It happens all the time. And we need to keep that in mind and speak accordingly. We need to ask the Lord to make it happen and speak and ask him in faith with that faith and understanding that he does have that power, and we need to pray that he gives us our life and breath and the opportunity to do the things that we would like to do to serve him, but then speak that way to give him the credit and glory for what we're able to do in his service, because we can't do that ourselves at all. And that's why in verses 16 and 17, to talk that way, to say, well, I'm going to, and then utter words of that sort, really then claiming a power that we can do things on our own without God, what is that? Well, in verse 16, he says, but now you rejoice in your boastings. All such rejoicing is evil. What does he call it? He calls it boasting. Well, is that humble or proud? I mean, we're really boasting, saying, I can do this. If that's how we're speaking, when can we? We really can't. And then we're saying we can do that. That's boasting. And the Lord tells us that's not good. And it's interesting, he says, but now you rejoice in your boastings. The word rejoice there, it's not the word for joy that we might be expecting there. It's the word that the Greek word there means to vaunt. It's another word for bragging. And just to note a couple of places where it's used, in Romans chapter 2 and verse 17, this was a problem some of these religious leaders were having in this time, of which we very easily can catch this same disease if we're not careful, but Which is why he teaches us about, warns us about this. But in Romans 2 and verse 17, he says, "Behold, thou art called a Jew, and restest in the law, and makest thy boast of God." Then in verse 23, he says, "Thou makest thy boast of the law." So there was a boasting of their position in that law that they had, in that law of Moses. And so that's the same word. They were vaunting themselves in that. Now, is there anything that we should vaunt? Is there any good kind of vaunting? Not in ourselves, but Romans chapter 5, verses 2 and 3. He says, "By whom also we have access by faith into this grace wherein we stand, and rejoice in hope of the glory of God." That's that same word, vaunt. That we rejoice in hope of the glory of God. Was that in ourselves or in the Lord? And then verse 3 says, "And not only so, but we glory." There's that same word again there. That's that word, it's kalkamai. It means to vaunt. "But we glory in tribulations also, knowing that tribulation worketh patience." So this is not in ourselves, but in God and his work that he does. So that's one passage that shows us what would be the what is proper to vaunt or boast in, not at all in ourselves. In fact, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, if we can turn there to verses 29 and through 31. Actually, we're going to go back. We'll back up to verse 27, because we'll see this principle comes out in what's going to also be there, the first part of James 5. But he says, "But God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise, and God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty, and base things of the world, and things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence." And there's that word again, to vaunt. No flesh should glory or vaunt itself in his presence. Verse 30, "But of him are ye in Christ Jesus, who of God has made unto us wisdom and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, that according as it is written, he that glorieth, let him glory in the Lord." And there's that same word again, translated glory there in verse 31. So vaunting, and when we're speaking that if God wills, we will live or do this or that, any vaunting then is turned towards whom? And who has the power and authority to be able to do that, to make us alive, to make us to be able to do whatever we might do? Then that's giving all of that to God. But when we say, "I will do it," then who are we vaunting? Ourselves. But here he says, rejoicing. So this is a double boasting in a sense. He says, "But now you rejoice, you vaunt in your boastings." And that word boastings means bragging. The only other time it's used in the New Testament is in 1 John 2:16, translated pride, the pride of life, which is not of the Father, but is of the world. So to vaunt in bragging, boasting and bragging. See, it's really a double thing. It shows how bad that is. He's referring to speaking in that way to say, "I will go, I'm going to go here, I will do this." And all such rejoicing, he says, and that's a form of that same word, to vaunt, is evil. That's the bottom line. So from start to finish, James chapter 4 really does cover many facets of pride. And he's teaching us to humble ourselves in the sight of the Lord, who will lift us up. But this is another way to do that. There are lots of different ways that he teaches us that here in James 4. the summary of it in verse 17. Therefore, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Now, is that a verse that's just hanging out in the air by itself? No, of course not. No verse is. Is there a general principle taught in that verse? And is there a specific application and context to that principle that is in verse 17? Well, yes, we do see a principle taught there. To him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. All right, well, who is the one that teaches us what is good that we can know that? So is there any, and of course that's God here in his word, is there any good thing that God teaches us in his word that we learn to do that if we then neglect to do it, that we're not guilty of sin? The answer would be no there. What's the definition of sin in 1 John chapter 3, verse 4? Sin is transgression of the law when we are breaking God's law. Well, we might think all of God's law is a bunch of thou shalt nots. There are a lot of thou shalt not. Don't do. He tells us things not to do. But he also tells us a lot of things to do, doesn't he? So it's not just don't do this. He tells us what we should do. He gives us both. What to do, what not to do. Well, if he tells us not to do something and we do it, are we transgressing his law? Yes. If he tells us we should do something, here's what he commands us to do something and then we don't do it, is that keeping his law or breaking his law? Like when he told King Saul to smite, to destroy all the Amalekites. And he went and did most of it. He only left the king alive and the very best of the flocks when the Lord said to destroy all of it. And so he came and says, I've obeyed the voice of the Lord. Well, had he? He had not. He had not obeyed God. He transgressed God's commandment because he didn't fully do what God commanded him to do. In how many ways can we transgress God's law? Well, we just consider two major ways, and one of them he's bringing up right there in verse 17. We can transgress his law by doing the things he commands us not to do, or to not do what he commands us to do. Well, is there a specific application here? Is there something good he's just taught us to do that if we don't do that, that he says is sin? What good thing did he just teach us to do? To say, if the Lord wills, we shall live or do this or that. If we don't speak that way, and I can remember when I was growing up, when I was younger, I can remember I threw out all kinds of statements like that without the understanding and then saying, well, if the Lord wills, I will do this. But then when we come to understand and to know that good that we should do, and if we don't change, if it doesn't change the way we speak, and we just keep talking like we used to talk with all that bragging, and we may not think that we're bragging when we're talking that way, but he says that's what we're doing. But if we don't stop all that boasting and then actually speak the way he says to, that if the Lord wills, we will do anything, then what is that? We know to do that good now. If we don't do it, what is it? It would be sin. So it is this an important teaching there? This is not something that's optional in God's sight. He's teaching us what we need to do to be humble, to humble ourselves before him and to glorify him and not be vaunting ourselves. And we have to do that, otherwise then we're going to be we'll be guilty of sin. So that's his finishing note there of James chapter 4 with that application that from what we have just studied about and the way that we should speak. But in how many other things was that not true when he teaches us what is good? If the Lord teaches us to do something, we need to do it. While this is on the subject of what is sin, are there any other verses in God's Word that speak about ways and... Or is there any other way to sin other than by doing what God says that we shall not do, or by not doing what He says we should do or must do? Okay, that's a good one. Romans 14, verse 23. That's the one I had down. We were on the same... Well, literally the same page there. Romans 14 and verse 23. This is another verse that tells us very specifically what can cause us to be in sin in the sight of God. Romans 14, 23. In the context here where he's talking about things that were... eating food that was sacrificed to idols, the background of, well, the majority of Christians in the first century was the majority. Now, at the very beginning, it was all Jews in Jerusalem that were converted to Christ. But by the time Paul has done his work, and particularly Paul, but others, and the gospel has spread all the way to Rome, at this point, and Romans was written when Paul was on his, at the very end of his third missionary journey, at this point, was what was the majority as far as the makeup of Christianity at this time? Jews or Gentiles? Gentiles by far. What kind of religious background did they come from? Idol worshiping. There weren't denominations around at that time that they were converted out of. So they most of them came from a background of worshiping idols. That's what they knew. And making offerings of food to idols, that was a common practice then. And where idols are worshipped on earth today, it remains a common practice. But people, the ones who came from that background, for them to eat what was offered to an idol, as far as their understanding was concerned, many of them, they regarded that as actually doing what? Yeah, that they were participating in the worship of the idol to do that. Now, is that necessarily the case? Did God define it that way, that if you touch, if you eat anything that was offered to an idol, that you are guilty of participating in the worship of idols? No. And without reading all of that, I mean, Romans chapter 14 is on that subject, which he makes it clear. That it is very possible for someone to eat with the understanding and knowledge that that is not the same as worshiping the idol. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, without reading that either right now, but that entire chapter is on the same subject, where he very clearly says that the idol is nothing, and therefore the food offered to what is an offering to a nothing? It's a nothing. And the idol is nothing. If we understand that the idol is nothing, then any little plate of food they put in front of that nothing, what would that be to us if we understand that? Somebody puts a good hamburger on there, be happy to eat that. I mean, the idol's not going to eat it. It's a nothing. So no reason to have that go to waste, right? But anyway, someone who understood the truth would be able to eat that and not be guilty of sin. But what if somebody didn't understand that, and then according to their understanding and conscience, eating that food offered to an idol would make them to be engaged in the worship of that idol. Should they do it or not? See, this is where the conscience is involved. If their conscience would tell them that eating that would be wrong, and if they eat it, what happens? Well, that's what Romans 14 speaks about. And he that doubteth is damned if he eat, because he eateth not of faith, for whatsoever is not of faith is sin. So in this context of the conscience, if something is against our conscience, and it's possible, as we can see in that case, that our conscience may tell us that something is wrong, that in God's sight is not actually wrong if we understand it properly. But if our conscience says that that's wrong for us to do, and we do something against our conscience, then what does God say that is? That's sin. Well, that's breaking a law of God right there. So those are some of the major ways in which we can fall into sin if we're not being very careful. Does it matter if we sin? If we transgress God's law? Yes, that will separate us from God. Now, looking at it from another way, and this is what we actually did when we were in chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. We were looking at the principle there, what he teaches about anger. Is that the final standard or the ultimate standard to govern our conduct or behavior, to find out whatever is God's law and then make sure we don't transgress that and fall into sin? If it's not an actual sin, then we'll be fine to do it. Well, there's actually a higher standard that we're given than that. And that's the one that we saw in James 1, verses 19 and 20. And it wouldn't hurt to revisit that now. But there he said in verse 19, "Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath." That word wrath being the Greek word orge, which is the common word for anger. Now, if we look at that very same word when he uses it in Ephesians 4, verse 26, when he says, "Be angry and sin not," which is not a command to be angry, obviously, because he, in verse 31 of Ephesians 4, says to put all anger away, just like he says here. It gives the devil an opportunity, a place, which he says, "Give no place to the devil." So in Ephesians 4, he tells us it is not necessarily sinful. It does very often lead to that, and it gives the devil an opportunity, because if we're angry, trying to control what we say and what we do and to do the right thing, say the right thing in the right way when we're angry, is that easier or difficult than when we're not angry? I mean, it's a hard enough job to bridle our tongues without that, but we are making adding a degree of difficulty to that task much greater there if we're angry. We're giving the devil an opportunity. So it's possible we can get through all of that and not commit sin. Now, is it likely? It's really not very likely, but it is possible. So technically, this anger in and of itself, is it a transgression of God's law? Is it a sin to have it? He says in Ephesians 4:26 it is not. But yet he says, put all of it away. And what does he say right here is the reason why? In verse 20 of James 1, he says, For the wrath, the anger of man, worketh not the righteousness of God. So what's the standard there to go by? Is it just to avoid sin, or is it to accomplish the righteousness of God in everything that we do? And is that one and the same? Well, we're certainly not accomplishing the righteousness of God if we're transgressing his law and committing sin. We're doing unrighteousness then. But it's a higher standard for us to look for whatever does not work as righteousness, and we will recognize there's more than one thing that would not be technically on the side of, or in the category of, a sin, that would not work God's righteousness, and therefore if we have good understanding, a proper understanding, and the right desire to please God in everything that we do, we'll put that away, like he tells us to do with anger. It does not work God's righteousness. There's not a single commandment of God in anything that is right in his sight that we're going to accomplish through anger. So we need to get rid of it, even though it's not technically or necessarily a sin. The fact that it puts us in danger and makes it easier to sin is another reason to not do it. It doesn't work God's righteousness, and it is very adept at leading us into unrighteousness. But there's the standard, and that's the right standard to use, which when he's teaching us about purging our conscience from dead works in Hebrews 9:15, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. Whatever is not serving the living God is a dead work, whether it's a sin or not. So, and what's the difference between doing everything that we do to serve the living God or to work the righteousness of God? Is there any difference between that? Serving the living God and doing the and working the righteousness of God, that's very much the same thing. So he teaches it, that standard, in James 1:20. He teaches it in Hebrews 9:15. That's what we need to go by. I mention this also because right now over in Atlanta, there are brethren that are now in a big fight over whether something that they all agree that God teaches that we shouldn't do, whether it is technically a sin or not. And so they're having a big fight over that, and they're going to be debating. It's getting more congregations and brethren involved over that, strictly over the issue about what category the action falls in, when they all recognize the scriptures teach we shouldn't be doing that. Does that, if we really understand the right standard that God calls us to, from one standpoint, is it going to really even matter to us what category it falls into technically? It really shouldn't. If God says that this doesn't work as righteousness, then we shouldn't do it. If it does work as righteousness, we should do it. Is that good enough for us? Well, is the Lord going to be pleased if we get in a big fight over trying to decide what category certain things are in? And it can be difficult at certain times to look at and say, well, is that something technically that's going to transgress his law, or is that just not working as righteousness? We may have some difficulty making that discernment. But if we recognize that the Lord is teaching us, okay, this isn't working my righteousness, then we know, okay, well, whatever technically that might be, let's get rid of that. Let's quit doing that. And if it does work as righteousness, let's do that. So James chapter 5 starts the same exact way with the very same words that chapter 4 verse 13 started with. Go to now. So as he said, go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city, continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain. Chapter 5 verse 1 says, go to now, ye rich men. So where in chapter 4 and verse 13, it was ones who speak in this boastful kind of way that he was saying, go to now, and very much like we would say, come now. We tend to say come instead of go when we're speaking in English after this fashion, but that's what that means. So now he's putting the attention on the ones who are rich. Go to now, you rich men. Weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. And then he's going to talk about what's going to happen with their riches. So now he's, and certainly, and we can see why this would be a very suitable or useful place to put a chapter break. I mean, there's definitely a change here in subject from what we saw at the down through verse 17. But it does tie into some of what was brought up in chapter 4, but also what has been brought up a number of times in the book of James, especially the first two chapters. He's going to be coming back to that here. So in James chapter 1, let's refresh on that. James chapter 1, verses 9 through 11. We ought to be able to see this, recognize this principle. It was also brought out in chapter 4. Can we see how in the book of James, things that he brings up, he goes back to repeatedly and then reteaches points with applications, further applications elsewhere in the book. So this is another case of that. James 1, 9 through 11, he says, "Let the brother of low degree rejoice in that he is exalted." What do we see in chapter 4? What does God do with the proud and what does he do with the humble? And we also saw it in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Who does God, when we read 1 Corinthians 1, 17 through 21 a while ago, who does God chiefly call? Who are the ones that make up his church? Is it the elite of this of our society, of our world? Who hates Christ more than the elites? Has that ever changed? It really has not ever changed, and it remains the case. The ones that are in his church, and it doesn't matter what age we're living in, what country we're in, it's the same truth everywhere. Brother Caleb can tell you about that over in India. I mean, how many of the well-to-do, the high people of society over there are in the Lord's church? How many here? How many anywhere? Whether it's this century or any century, the Lord calls the ones that are despised, the base things of the world, the ones that are not, to confound the mighty. And he's bringing that out here also. Let the brother of low degree, that would be most brethren, compared to the world, low degree. And he says, rejoice in that he is exalted. Well, the Lord can take us when we humble ourselves. He will exalt us in due time, but when he takes us, even if we're of low degree in this world, and he puts us in heavenly places in Christ Jesus, in the position that he does as a member of his body with our citizenship in his eternal kingdom, that's an exalting, isn't it? And that's something to rejoice in. So that's something spiritual. Verse 10, he says, "But the rich in that he is made low, because as the flower of the grass he shall pass away. For the sun is no sooner risen with a burning heat, but it withereth the grass, and the flower thereof falleth, and the grace of the fashion of it perisheth, so also shall the rich man fade away in his ways." So what is he saying about the things of this world? And if that's what we love, it's all going to be gone. And if that's that is a temptation for the ones who have much of this world's good. So the warning is there. All that is, we're going to be gone off of this world very soon. We're not taking anything with us. We better not, if all we do is love these things here that we had, and we're not prepared for eternity, then we've made a very foolish decision. What does he say there in chapter 2, James chapter 2, verses 5 through 7, when brethren were favoring someone who was coming into the assembly who was rich over a poor man? Now, does that sound like a proper way to judge, especially considering what the Lord says, like we just read in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, 17 through 21. That's not wise. And he brings up this point in James chapter 2, 5 through 7. Hearken, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the poor of this world rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he hath promised to them that love him? But you have despised the poor. Do not rich men oppress you and draw you before the judgment seats? Do not they blaspheme that worthy name by which you are called? So he's reminding them again of the way things work in this world. Those that are in Christ are not, by and large, in fact, it's going to be the exception that they would be of the rich of this world. The rich of this world are the ones that are doing the persecuting of Christians. How much persecution of Christianity is conducted by poor people? I mean, just think about that. They don't have the means to do it even if they wanted to do it. I mean, the ones who can actually organize that and make that happen, I mean, these are people with the power and this world's goods to be able to do that. And he's referring to that fact there in James chapter 2. Why would they be favoring? We shouldn't judge by the outward man in any way, but why would they favor the rich over the poor, knowing that? So that was a foolish and wrong thing. But we saw that he was teaching against that kind of judging in chapter 2. Well, then in chapter 4, what was he pointing out was one of the big problems that some of these brethren were having in verses 2 through 4 particularly? It says, you lust and have not, you kill and desire to have and cannot attain, you fight and war and you have not because you ask not, you ask and receive not because you ask it amiss that you may consume it upon your lusts. You adulterers and adulteresses, know you not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. And why is that so foolish? What did we see in chapter 1? What happens with all of these material things? How long do they last? Not long at all. They're going to be gone. We'll be gone. And so that's very foolish to love those things and to be God's enemy and then face an eternity where the one who made us, we've made ourselves his enemy because we haven't loved him but rather what he made. So now he gets back to this point of the rich men in chapter 5, verse 1, where he says, go to now, you rich men, weep and howl for your miseries that shall come upon you. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver is cankered, and the rust of them shall be a witness against you, and shall eat your flesh as it were fire. So there are two big points in there that we're not going to have the time to explore in depth right now. We'll have to put off to next week. But one of them is they should weep and howl for the miseries that will come upon you. Is there a judgment coming for them? Yes. And then furthermore, what about all these things that they have and love? What's going to happen with that? So then these people he's referring to here are going to be facing the Lord in judgment with nothing remaining of what they love, and only to be facing their Maker, who's going to judge them for having loved this world and not sought and lived for him. So that's really a double reason for them to weep and howl, isn't it? They're going to lose it all, and then they're going to be judged for it in eternity. So let's plan to continue our study of that, Lord willing, next Wednesday night. And we'll stop here with our study now.